Welcome to Citizens Climate Radio. In this show, we highlight people's stories, we celebrate your successes, and together we share strategies for talking about climate change. I'm your host, Peter Santoscano. Welcome to episode 34 of Citizens Climate Radio, a project of Citizens Climate Education. This episode is airing on Saturday, March 23rd, 2019. Later in the show, you will hear our monthly puzzler question. Also, dancer and climate advocate Hope Clark returns to the Art House. She tells us about the parachute project she had been working on. Hope has moved on to new work. She is exploring addictions, her own addiction to cigarette smoking, and how it is connected to our society's addiction to fossil fuels. She's exploring these connections through dance. But first, lately, we have been hearing a lot of this.
Climate change is not a lie! Please don't let our planet die!
Climate change is not a lie! Please don't let our planet die!
Keep it in the soil! Can't drink oil! Keep it in the soil! Can't drink oil! Keep it in the soil!
On March 15th, 2019, tens of thousands of high school, middle school, and elementary school children walked out of class. They gathered in public spaces demanding adults take action to address climate change. I attended one of these protests in Honolulu, Hawaii, and chatted with young people and adults, including two 12-year-old girls, Violet and Sophia.
Everyone can do something to help. And that was a big part of it, is because it was really about youth and about our opinions and how we can make a difference.
And I shared about SMART goals, specific, measurable, attainable, reasonable, and time-bound goals that the government could use to help create goals for Hawaii and all the other states. I'm surprised by how many children are taking action and becoming like vegetarians, and they are speaking up for what they believe in. And I believe that's very good.
Violet's mom, Krista, shared her frustrations with me. She also shared insights into how this issue is different for younger people.
I actually feel like really cranky and irritated, and it doesn't feel like enough, and it's Friday afternoon, and why isn't everybody here, and every kid here, and every parent here, and every teacher here? And just like Greta says, if this is such a big crisis, why is it 3 to 5 on a Friday? And I just feel like angry, not excited here. And I realize that it's different for kids because it's been the simmering background thing for them their whole life, and it's not just a big aha moment that they can go, oh wow, that thing. That it's this almost like a background simmering white noise.
I also spoke with one of the lead organizers.
Kavika Pagram. I'm a junior at Waipahu High School. I'm 17 years old. Well, this gathering, and by the way, over 2,000 other gatherings just like this around the world, they really show that youth have a voice, and that when things need to be done, the youth have the capability of doing it. And so in this instance, it was climate change and how we can further advance. How we can further advance just our movement on climate change, reducing our greenhouse gases, going to 100% renewable energy. All those sweet and wonderful things that we need to get done in such a short amount of time, youth are capable of organizing that. And I think that's one of the biggest messages that we're sending today. And so our next steps are going to be kind of formulating a movement behind this and how we're going to get real legislative action from this, because this is a very good start. It really shows that there's hope and that there's interest, but now we need to turn that interest into action.
Back in episode 9, I chatted with Eileen Flanagan. Eileen spoke to us about the 4 different roles change agents take.
And the names we've given them are helper, advocate, organizer, and rebel. And they show up in all kinds of ways. And the way to think of it is really, what is their orientation?
I want to dig deeper into these roles and have been talking to people who embody them. Later this year, you will hear from a very successful advocate. But on today's show, I chat with a rebel. Eileen explains the role of the rebel.
In contrast, a rebel uses disruptive tactics. They don't do letter writing. They don't do lobbying. Instead, they do protests of various kinds. In my tradition, we usually use nonviolent direct action, targeting a decision maker, maybe a corporation, and trying to get them to change a policy through consistent troublemaking.
The rebel on today's show comes from England. Meet Robin Boardman. A university student in Bristol, England, Robin is always up for an adventure.
I'm a bit of an adrenaline junkie. Love going to the south coast of Spain and jumping off the highest rocks that I can find.
Robin's adventures have taken a more political tone recently.
What I've been doing in previous months, blockading streets, shouting in the halls of Parliament, and going on a hunger strike, that has definitely been quite a bit of adrenaline going through my system as I do those things, because that is just not the person I am. I actually quite like pleasing people and making people happy, but that is not how systems change. Systems change when civil disobedience encounters a system that is so toxic, and it disrupts. And some people will get mad by that, and other people will join it because they realize that these people are dedicated and they've been prepared to do what it takes to make something happen. So I guess I get my adrenaline from those these days.
Perhaps Robin's most daring action happened last fall. It was one of the first major nonviolent direct action events organized by the group known as Extinction Rebellion.
Yeah, so I think one of the most beautiful actions I've been a part of was the Rebellion Day, November 17th, 2018, when we blocked five of the major bridges in London with around 5,000 to 6,000 people. It was a beautiful, crisp morning. You know, we're worried about the kind of, you know, if it's going to rain. It would just massively put off the whole action. There was a lot of prep that went into that action from the early hours of the morning, people up and alert, as many will know who have been part of direct action, is that kind of like adrenaline beforehand, which kind of surges through your system and keeps you awake for what's about to come. And it was just this beautiful still morning when you get to it with all the equipment. There were a large number of police sort of around each of the bridges and coming up and chatting to us as we were preparing beforehand. The beauty of it was that we didn't mind. You know, we knew exactly what we were there to do. They knew what we were there to do. And we were honest about it and we were open about it. And that's a key part of our organizing, is to keep that open and honesty running through what we do. We moved as one. We had a sort of a briefing circle where we talked about what we were going to do in terms of blocking off the bridge from both ends with small affinity groups, which are, for listeners that don't know, direct action support groups, people who support an action to happen or do the action itself. So these groups then took either side of the bridge. I was on Blackfriars Bridge. I was helping to coordinate the action on that bridge. So on Blackfriars, I think we had about 600, 700 initially. And as the day went on, the sort of bridges at the far end started to drop off, and they would come and meet up with the other bridge to build into a large march that would then go straight to Parliament Square. So as the day went on, we actually got more and more people coming to Blackfriars Bridge because it was closer to the square. We were there for roughly 5 hours, I think, blocking off a major bridge in London, which had a huge disruptive effect on the economy of a city, which is a key thing that we're trying to challenge. You need to challenge a government economically to make something happen. There's nothing quite like seeing a plan come together. So when you saw all these groups take the bridge, and then the speakers came onto the middle of it, and everyone just sat down in this peaceful moment again on this beautiful clear sky morning, I just felt this massive gratitude around what we have done and what we are doing. And then we just had a party basically to celebrate what we had just achieved and how we were actively in resistance against the UK government and in an act of mass civil disobedience not seen for decades in the UK.
Extinction Rebellion wants to bring about change. They recognize they do not need to have everyone involved.
So building on the research of people like Erica Chenoweth, who recognized that we need 3.5% of the population mobilized in order to create a system change.
While they are not proposing any specific solution to climate change, their main goal is to provoke climate action. Extinction Rebellion and those organizing with them have three clear demands.
Our first demand to the government is to tell the truth about the climate crisis, about the ecological emergency, and act as if that truth is real and stop hiding from it, which is the classic kind of positivism outlook. Western capitalism says the more you get in life, the better it's going to be. And it's going to be a sort of positive incline as you go throughout. And we all know that's not the case. So that's the first demand, is telling the truth. The second is that the government goes zero carbon by 2025 and starts to draw down some of that carbon that's already in our atmosphere, as well as limiting the use of resources across the world to below half the Earth's natural resources for a year. And our third demand, finally, is declare a citizens' assembly, to enact a citizens' assembly, which would have the voting rights around how we escape this crisis. So the citizens' assembly would be decided by a system called sortition, which is essentially the random selection of people across a population that would be representative of that population.
In order to compel leaders and society to agree to these demands, Extinction Rebellion takes on the traditional role of the rebel. They exert pressure on leaders in hopes of seeing systems change.
We're trying to create dilemma actions, essentially. It's actions whereby the authorities or whoever is in power in that situation are put into a dilemma about, okay, so do we arrest these peaceful protesters for sitting on a road, you know, people from the ages of 3 to 85 for simply sitting on a road in mass numbers, or do we allow this protest to happen and allow this mass disruption of civil society to continue? And it's a win-win either way for the rebellion, because either they arrest massive amounts of people and massively boost our cause in terms of the publicity cause, the sort of sacrifice people made, and how that ripples throughout society, or they allow that protest to continue and create that space that says, okay, so if we want to block 5 bridges in London, the police are going to allow it to happen. And in such a way, can start to facilitate the downfall of the UK government, because they are allowing us to block and disrupt the economy, which is, as you know, the research from Erica and others shows, crucial about how we bring about this system change.
And to do so, Extinction Rebellion has very clear values and principles.
Things like, we are a strictly nonviolent organization, that we build a regenerative culture, a culture of well-being, looking after each other and recognizing that we're in a toxic system, and other principles and values along these lines. One of those key values is around autonomy and decentralization. So we are not becoming another sort of NGO type hierarchical organization, but instead we are building a network where those who agree on these principles and values around nonviolence and around autonomy can then go off and create their own groups and take their own actions.
In addition to the outward work of protests and political actions, Robin highlights how Extinction Rebellion also looks inward. They spend time exploring the deep and challenging idea of grief in a time of climate change.
Grief is an amazingly important part about what we're doing, because what we're facing is horrific. And it's so painful to take in. Many of us who are part of the rebellion have been through this grieving process of recognizing what is currently happening, and it's so hard to take in. And it often, you know, might mean that you have to go off into the woods and go for a walk for a while, and you might sit down and cry, and we're saying that that's totally okay. In fact, you know, we should be doing that, because that's what makes us human, because we recognize what's happening in an emotional way. Going through that process, going through this process of grief and truly recognizing the situation that we're in, is actually a massively liberating thing. In the same way that, you know, if someone tells you you have cancer, for example, then you're bound to go through a strong period of grief around your kind of upcoming physical health, you know, whether you might die. Lots of cancer patients do go through that process, and afterwards they appreciate much greater the smaller things in their life, their relationships with other people.
We are living in a time where we see increased political action. On March 15, 2019, tens of thousands of students left the classroom to voice their alarm about climate change. They have a powerful message.
In terms of the student strikes that are currently happening, I think it's important that students do go on strike, but I think it's important that they also take action. And so we've got some of our groups looking in Belgium, for example, and have been recently, not just saying, okay, this is a day to strike on Fridays, but this is a day not only strike, but to block off all the roads around our school and say, we're not going to take cars coming in around our school anymore because it's poisoning our lungs. And that's a strong message, and one that's heard because of the action that they're taking.
Robin and Extinction Rebellion are pursuing profound changes in government and society. To do so, they are organizing people.
Quite often, there's this sort of romantic story that people tell about history where, if you know, you want to create a system change, then the people need to rise up and make that change happen. And, you know, that sounds like, okay, well, the whole population just swings against what it previously was. Well, it's not quite accurate when we know that, well, actually what we need is around 3.5% of the population to give a damn. And that's the key, is mobilizing to that figure. And so we have our mission set on mobilizing that. Key failing of the environmental movement for the last 30 years is that the actions have not been properly coordinated around system change. And particularly here in the UK, and I'm sure it's similar in the States, that lots of environmental groups have focused around local issues, you know, this fracking site near me, this thing over here, and not on the wider system level issues.
They have big plans for more actions.
So what we're calling for is an international rebellion beginning on the 15th of April and going for at least a week after that, and learning from the history of civil resistance in the global south, so places like Burma and the Philippines, to use economic disruption as a key tactic in calling for this change. So we'll be taking to the streets of London. In the UK, we already have 1,500 people who said they're going, and I'm sure those numbers will swell. And we plan to block the streets of London day after day in the major intersections until the government meets our demands.
In a time of climate disruptions and an uncertain future, young people are looking for a sense of purpose. This is what spoke to Robin when he first heard about the growing rebellion movement.
This felt to a real call to action, something that I could really put my effort and my heart into, because I knew that what this was talking about was the right thing and what was needed given the situation. You know, what I feel is this deep sense of purpose with those around me, within coordinating XR and with all local groups and others that I've worked with, is that we are working towards something greater than ourselves, and that we can commit ourselves fully to that. And that's a beautiful thing. ¶¶
To learn more about the work of Extinction Rebellion, visit their website, rebellion.earth. You can also follow them on Twitter at ExtinctionR. Now it is time for the Art House. Back in episode 18, I introduced you to Hope Clark. She is a dancer, concerned about climate change. She was so concerned, she decided to engage her community in the Washington, D.C. area in a public art project. To do so, she used giant parachutes.
And at that time, I really just wanted to understand the effects of heat trapping gases, and it was kind of a high school, middle school kind of thing to learn. And I was able to do that in my community with high school students and middle school students and explore that creatively. That, came to be a large outdoor performance piece. And it was a wonderful experience to learn about my community in that way and what they're ready for, what they weren't ready for, what they were interested in, and who responded and how they responded, and also how I could handle it. You know, how could I handle a 100-foot parachute in the middle of a big field, all of the work it takes to organize all of those people? And so it was a challenging performance, but for me, the best was really lucky that I did hire somebody to shoot it. You know, so I was able to make a little 10, 11 minute video. I really was able to distill the message I wanted to distill. And then I felt as if I had something that I could say, look, this is what I think is important. And this is what I'm doing. And this is what I'm interested in. And so that was a valuable process for me.
Creating an art piece can help us process our thoughts and feelings about a topic as large and challenging as climate change. No surprise then, once she completed the Make a Movement Parachute Community Project, Hope began to go deeper into her own feelings.
I think I just realized, like, let me just let this go for a minute, the parachute thing. Let me get back to my body and my movement and what I'm good at, because I can't make anybody else dance the way I dance. I know some choreographers do that. They teach them their movement and all that stuff. But for me, it's always about the message and, you know, what's important to me.
Since you listen to this program, I imagine you're someone actively engaged in climate work. It's hard work. We live with fears and stress over the issue. We can feel frustration, anger, and sadness. How do you cope with these feelings? We all seek out comfort in different ways. Hope found herself returning to an old comfort, an addiction to cigarette smoking.
I worked in a film festival doing community engagement again about documentary films and getting people to talk about very important issues. And what was I doing? I was smoking. It's like, what? I mean, I'm not 25 years old anymore. What am I doing? It just felt so dumb. And it was ridiculous. It was like totally unsatisfying and yet totally like something I had to do. It was very disconnected.
Hope felt concerned about picking up this old habit. She also made a connection to her work as a climate advocate.
I think we're addicted to our lifestyles. In order to change, you know, to get off plastic and to get off our cars and to get off and to change, there's a similar kind of like comfort, you know, addictions are comfortable. Oh, if I'm gonna ask all these people to change, that's my incentive. Every time I want to run away and cover up something, I think about that. And I center, and I let myself cry, whatever I have to do, you know. And I feel better.
So Hope began to dance. She choreographed movements to explore the grief she feels over climate change. Just chatting with Hope, you can see how expressive she is with her body. Still, she felt she needed more than pure movement. She needed words. She created a script she has recorded and uses it as the score to her dance.
Now that I stop smoking, will my brain work better or worse? considering I've transferred my desperate sense of anxiety to alcohol and sugar. Desperate about the uncertainty of our future, my mind wants to walk over to that local store and buy tobacco to shove down my throat in a big inhale. Let me just breathe in something toxic, something worse than my thoughts. I want to fill in that void.
I mean, whenever I've been a performer, I wasn't smoking. There's a connection to that. And I think it's because when I'm dancing, I am feeling my feelings, and it is flowing right through me, and I am feeling very healthy and centered. It's a perfect process to let go of that craving and to go back into a practice that always did make me happy. I think you get to one place and then it asks for another place to grow. And so I'm ready to work on this one for a while, to listen to the recording and to record it in different ways and to shape a little bit and find opportunities to share. Just like, I mean, I might go on into a bar stage and just be like, oh, excuse me, this is my mic, open mic. So that's fine. It's part of the act. It's part of the action. It's part of my action. It's part of my art action.
You can see Hope Clark in action over at vimeo.com/HopeClark. If you have an idea for the Art House, contact me, radio@citizensclimate.org. That email is radio@citizensclimate.org. Now it is time for the monthly Citizens Climate Radio Puzzler Question. I am going to repeat the question from last month because I want to give more listeners a chance to answer it. So here's the puzzler. You ready? You are at a family dinner when you mention your excitement about more and more people becoming concerned about climate change. Your Uncle Ralph interrupts. Global warming? Seriously? What about all this record cold weather we've had this winter? It doesn't seem like it's warming at all. So what do you say? How can you open up a conversation about climate change that doesn't just turn into a debate? Send me your answers, leave your name, your contact info, and where you're from. Get back to me by April 15th, yeah, tax day in the USA, 2019. You can email your answers to radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. You can also leave me a voicemail of 3 minutes or less at the following number, 518-595-9414. Plus one if you're calling from outside the USA. That number again is 518-595-9414. We have come to the end of our program. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Radio. The show is written and produced by me, Peterson Toscano. Other technical support from Ricky Bradley and Brett Cease. Social media assistance from Ashley Hunt Monterano, Flannery Winchester, Allison Kubisco, and Steve Volk. Moral support from Madeline Pera. Be sure to share Citizens Climate Radio with your friends. You can find Citizens Climate Radio wherever you listen to podcasts, including iTunes, Spotify, Podbean, SoundCloud, TuneIn, and Stitcher Radio. You can also listen at northernspiritradio.org. Join the discussion at our Facebook group page, facebook.com/groups/citizensclimateradio. You can follow us on Twitter at Citizens C Radio. That's Citizens, the letter C, Radio, at Citizens C Radio. I want to give a very special thank you to CCL Seattle and Silicon Valley North Citizens Climate Lobby for being such great boosters of this program and always sending out tweets about us on Twitter. Thank you so much. I really, really, really appreciate that. Visit citizensclimatelobby.org/blog to see info about our puzzler and find links to our guests. And there's a dig deeper section where we have more information for you. Citizens Climate Radio is a project of Citizens Climate Education.
Hi, aloha. And I came out just to support students. I mean, this, I think it's amazing to have student leadership and youth leadership on this issue, and I want to be here to support that.